Hey, everybody. Happy New Year. This is Brett. You might remember me from a podcast that I did last year called School Sucks Podcast. I'm going to do it again this year. And you know what is new besides the year? The SchoolSucksProject.com new website. And by this evening on January 1st, you should be able to put in SchoolSucksProject.com and see a brand new, an amazing new website. And I'm going to make an intro video because this site, so many things available to you here that were not available on our last site. As far as functionality is concerned, you might remember our last site had no functionality. It looked like something that some conspiracy theorist made in 1998. This new site is not like that at all. Now, you many of you are probably part of these social networks. You know, what are the popular ones today? MySpace, is that one? You will see that when you go to SchoolSucksProject.com, a lot of similar interactions are available. You can make a profile. You can have friends. You can see an activity feed. You can have your own activity feed. You can message other users. You can create and join groups. So if there's a particular area within this, you know, big umbrella of education that you want to focus on and you want to interact with people on that specific subject, create a group. Each group has its own forums. There is a main forum page where you can see obviously all the forums, but then you can specify where you want to go based on the groups. Many of you also might be familiar with Free Talk Live's main page where they have user-submitted links. We will also have that. If you look at our top nav bar, you will see one of the options, one of the drop-down menus is live show. And you will see in that drop-down, submit show prep. A lot of people send me email and they say, Brett, you should talk about this. Brett, you should talk about that. And, you know, I always look at what they ask me to talk about and I bookmark a few things, maybe do a little research. And a lot of those shows I just don't get around to doing with everything else that's been going on. But this is a more scientific way to get your suggestions onto the show. These submissions can be upvoted. And I think we're going to say that, you know, if something gets 5 upvotes, it should be included as it should be included in the show. It's something we can at least devote 20 minutes to. So I hope you'll go. I hope you'll make an account. Gosh, I hope you will join the AV Club, our bonus content section, where there is right now almost 150 additional pieces of content. But you can click on the AV Club drop-down menu if you're not a member, and you can see all the different categories. There's a lot of unreleased live material back from before we were even doing the Thursday night show. A lot of stuff with me and Gardner, Wes Bertrand and Richard Grove. So there's definitely some quality material in there. There's a lot of archive shows. If you're a newer listener, there's probably, maybe as many as 30 shows that you've never heard or seen before because they've been taken out of the podcast feed. I took about 25 shows out of the podcast feed back in March, 9 months ago. So there might be some pleasant and exciting new discoveries for you in that section. You can sign up. You'll see there's a support tab. You can click Join AV Club and several different options for monthly contributions. We asked for 6 to get access. But at the very least, I really hope you'll go and make an account so you can participate in the site, share links, join groups, make forum posts. Really would be helpful if people would comment on some of the podcast posts, and you can share them on Facebook, Twitter. All that stuff is very, very easy to do once you are logged in. And consider joining this AV Club, even if you don't want more content, because it supports the show, keeps the show going and growing. We had a very, very good year in 2012 in just about every way imaginable, probably except for technical difficulties. It was probably our greatest year for technical challenges, but that was because we tried to do a lot of new things in 2012. And, you know, you might find all kinds of wonderful new material in the AV Club. People have said, Brett, why don't you do a cooking show? Brett, why can't we see more behind-the-scenes stuff? Where can we see you do impressions of Al Pacino? Why don't you do a whole other show that's more like Puke in the Gang or Wheels Off Liberty? All of that stuff is in there. And I'm very proud of it, and we're going to add new stuff to it every week. So please consider doing that. It is very, very helpful. Also, some other news. Last Thursday, the show you're going to hear on this podcast was from last Thursday. It was our last Thursday night show. I have taken the show off LRN as a live show. We are going to continue to do the live show with a more relaxed format on Ustream only. It is going to be on Saturday evening and into the night, probably about a 4-hour time slot. And it'll also allow us to do a more in-depth exploration of a lot of the topics that we cover on the show. So this show from last Thursday, there was a couple of technical challenges. We were snowed in, and I was at another studio in Ware, New Hampshire, the Sex, Lies, and Anarchy podcast studio. And usually for the live show, I'm running two different machines. One is doing the Ustream, one is doing the recording and the Skype. But in this case, I tried to run everything out of one machine, and that created a few like glitches in the audio. The show is definitely listenable, but you'll hear like some cuts and some static when we take a call. Sarah calls in towards the end of the show. Sarah, you might remember from the School Sucks at the Movies, Charlie Bartlett, home educator, whose input I always really appreciate. So I included her phone call, but it's a little staticky, and I think you can get through it, and all these problems will be solved by next Saturday. So that's the news. This is School Sucks Podcast, episode 184, Youth Marketing, Same Old Tricks. My co-hosts are Corey and Celestina. Our discussion is based off a left-wing, agenda-driven documentary called Consuming Kids. It is available on YouTube. It's 66 minutes long if you want to watch it before you listen to this show. Thank you for listening, and take care.
Childhood culture has changed dramatically.
Kids, this is a toy you've got to have.
Look at the fun Debbie and Andy are having with these realistic ride-em toys.
Although it's true there was advertising to children back in the 1950s, the 1960s, even in the 70s, the amount of it was very confined in comparison to today.
You want to get a slinky.
From the time children come into the world, everyone's trying to make them a consumer.
Kids are being marketed to through brand licensing, through product placement, through viral marketing, marketing in schools.
We're going to get new equipment and stuff, and McDonald's people are going to give us money.
There's DVDs, there's video games, there's the internet, there are iPods, there are cell phones, where you can download video.
Watch videos, catch cast interviews, interact with a favorite Wildcat.
There's now ad for books, and there are ad for songs.
Not just ads, not just games, they're ad for games.
Hotels are marketing to kids, and car companies are marketing to kids, even airlines, you know, are marketing to kids.
You're sending one lucky winner to Hawaii, courtesy of Hawaiian Airlines.
Kids have far more influence today, and it adds up to about $1 trillion every year. That's a big business.
What we have is the rise of 360-degree immersive marketing, where they try and get around the child at every aspect, at every avenue.
They go into supermarkets with them and film exactly how they look at a product, pick it up, put it back down, the way they move around a supermarket. They film them on the playground. They film them in school. They film them eating breakfast. They film them going into their closet and deciding what to wear.
What are the things that you need that aren't in here?
I need a lot
of... They film them talking to their friends. They organize little friendship circles and film what they're doing. They even follow them into the bathroom. It's creepy. It's just absolutely creepy.
Their goal is to insinuate their brands into the fabric of children's lives.
Can I help you?
Yeah, here to see this?
Go ahead.
So the philosophy becomes cradle to grave. Let's get to them early. Let's get to them often. Let's get to them as many places as we can get them. And our goal is not just to sell them products and services, but to turn them into lifelong consumers.
Jimmy Choo flip flops. Where is my pink Prada tote? I need my Tiffany hairband. Then I can go for a quote.
We're creating a future generation of super consumers.
I want more.
That's the basic consumer identity. It's shallow. It's about me. It's about me now, and it's about me and these things.
They're at the time in their life when they're forming kind of all their values and attitudes. They're in the formative stages.
Shit, I impress myself sometimes.
There's really a clear, very extreme division between what boys learn and what girls learn. Boys are tough, strong, ready to fight.
Walk much?
And girls, they need to be pretty, sexy, and how they look determines their value. It objectifies both of them.
I mean, where did she find that outfit? Like, Ugly R Us?
More like Ugly R Her.
We are so funny.
And pretty.
I love us.
We need, in a proactive, forward-looking way as a society, to say, how is this changing us? How is this changing our environment? How is this changing our society? And do we want this?
We need to look at this as a systemic problem, look at this as a societal and a cultural problem, and say, we need to protect children from corporate marketing.
We're the only industrialized country in the world that really doesn't have a policy about this.
What does that mean for our future, for our well-being, and for their well-being?
One in three children born in the year 2000 will develop diabetes.
Children and a high blood pressure.
Obesity.
Type 2 diabetes.
Antidepressants for children.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
ADHD.
There is going to be a health care crisis, a concrete health care crisis.
Life expectancy of kids today will be shorter than that of their parents. The first such decline in modern times.
At what point should children and families take precedence over corporate profits?
We have become a country that places a lower priority on our children's emotional, cognitive, social, even spiritual development than it does on training them to be little consumers.
This is a lot more than about selling products and services. This is about the direction in which we are going as a culture, as a society, and as human beings.
From The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Chapter 17, The Politics of Schooling. Section 218, Freud's Nephew. Early in the 20th century, official language, including official school language, became a deliberate, systematic exercise in illusion. Governments have always lied, of course, but at the beginning of the 20th century, an accretion of psychological insights gathered from past epochs of magic, theology, philosophy, arts, warfare, rumor, and madness were collected, codified, and the conclusions were sold to the leaders of political states, global corporations, and other powerful interests, wielded into technology of professional dishonesty. Secrets of crowd behavior and the presumed instrumental wiring of the human nature were made available to anyone with the price of admission. The newly official pragmatic philosophy became a kind of anti-morality, superior to any ethical code fashioned out of custom and philosophy. 400 years after Niccolo Machiavelli wrote his treatise on scientific deceit, Edward L. Bernays began to practice the scientific art of public deception, trading heavily on his uncle Sigmund Freud's notoriety. A decade earlier, Ivy Lee's publicity savvy had rescued the Rockefellers from their Ludlow massacre disgrace. Public relations, as political science, was off and running on the fast track. Bernays was only a solitary word magician at the time, of course, but he was in an ideal position to capitalize quickly upon his rhetorical talent and to set his stamp on the new science's future. In 1928, Bernays published two books in quick succession, which planted his flag in the dream terrain of the unconscious. The first, Crystallizing Public Opinion, and the second, Propaganda. Adolf Hitler is said to have displayed both on a table in his office under a poster-sized picture of Henry Ford. The New World was blazing a trail into an even newer world than it imagined. Both of Bernays' books argued that language could be used successfully to create new realities. Psychological science was so advanced, he claimed, that it could substitute synthetic reality for natural reality, as urban society had successfully replaced our natural connection to birds, trees, and flowers with a substitute connection to billboards, cars, and bright lights. Crystallizing Public Opinion and Propaganda had much to say to the newly minted administrative classes burgeoning all over American schools and colleges. In Propaganda, Bernays redefined democratic society in the interests of the mass production economy. I've selected these three short excerpts from Bernays' classic, which enriched him with corporate work in the 7 decades of life he had left. He died in 1995 at the age of 105 after its publication. The first assertion of Propaganda was that common people had to be regimented and governed from behind the scenes. Here are Bernays' actual words. Quote, "The need for invisible government has been increasingly demonstrated. The technical means have been invented and developed by which public opinion maybe regimented. Unquote. The next important contention was that the critical pollution of language necessary to make this work was already in use. Quote, we are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. We are dominated by a relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public. Unquote. Finally, Bernays attempts to provide a moral justification for proceeding as he suggests. Quote, the conscious manipulation of all the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in a democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power in this country. Unquote. This attitude of manipulation as an important component of democratic, in quotes, management entered the urban factory school classroom in a big way at a time when psychology was taking over from academics as a tool of choice in America's German-inspired teacher training institutions. Bertrand Russell had been both a witness and an actor in the new climate of public deceits which characterized the post-World War I epoch. When its first phase was complete, he wrote in The Impact of Science on Society, 1952, that the most important subject for the future would be mass psychology and propaganda, studies which would be, quote, rigidly confined to the governing class. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they were put in boxes and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
I'll say it. These marketers are very similar to pedophiles, okay? They are child experts. If you're going to be a pedophile or a child marketer, you have to know about children and what children are going to want.
Kids love advertising. It's a gift. It's something they want. There's something to be said, by the way, about being there first and about branding children and owning them in that way. And antisocial behavior in pursuit of a product is a good thing.
We all watched this documentary that I wanted to discuss tonight called Consuming Kids. And this was about how marketers and advertisers have targeted children, really, since they have this point that they want to start at, like in the early 1980s was when all this began.
Well, it's not really where it began.
It was brand new, according to this documentary. It started in the 1980s. With Reagan.
No, didn't they have this whole bit about how it started in the 50s? No?
But they talk a little bit about, like, there was television advertising marketed to kids in the 50s, but this is a very – this documentary, Consuming Kids, while I think it contains some valuable information, has a very, very liberal bias.
Oh, so, definitely.
Really, what they did do in the documentary was they claimed that in the early 1980s, that mm-hmm. the Federal Trade Commission was kind of declawed. And right. they couldn't properly regulate. One of the people interviewed in the film said they had – the FTC had the power stolen from them
yes.
by Congress was the language that they actually used.
Which is a very interesting choice of words.
Yeah. And then you see that as they're talking about this, they're showing Reagan like celebrating being elected and
right.
like, this was the end of wholesome America. So – and then what goes on from there is like basically a lot of adults having this conversation with each other about advertising and targeting it towards kids. But there's never really any kids in that conversation. So what it is it's basically a warning film, you know, documentary. There's got to be a bad guy, obviously. There has to be a target for the film. But it's saying that essentially laissez-faire philosophy contributed to these abusive, predatory practices in marketing and advertising towards kids.
Right.
And the film does make some good points.
It does.
But what were general thoughts for you?
Like you said, I think it made some good points. I think it was definitely liberally biased in a really disingenuous way.
How so?
Like the biggest example that come to mind was when they had the one child psychiatrist on talking.
Yeah.
And he said that these guys, these youth marketers, there's an entire like job title, which is youth marketer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. These youth marketers are like pedophiles.
Mm.
And then he went on to explain like they're like pedophiles because they know children so well. Like if you want to be a successful pedophile or a successful youth marketer, you have to know everything about children.
Yeah.
And that was just like the most disingenuous comment in the entire thing, which is actually saying something because, you know, by his logic, the child psychiatrists, which he was, are also like pedophiles.
Good point.
Yeah.
They know probably more than any. I mean, child psychiatrists would make the best pedophiles.
So it's our composition and division fallacies again.
Right.
I will say this, though, that the person who was interviewed, and when I turn this into a podcast, I'll play a clip of this person, this woman, right, who was very creepy. She looked like a skeleton that somebody had stretched some skin over. She was one of these marketing people.
And somebody asked me, you know, Lucy, is that ethical? You know, you're essentially manipulating these children. Well, yeah, is it ethical? I don't know. But our role at Initiative is to move products. And if we know you move products with a certain creative execution, place in a certain type of media vehicle, then we've done our job. They are tomorrow's consumer, the tomorrow's adult consumer. So start talking with them now, build that relationship when they're younger, and you've got them as an adult.
And then one of the clips afterwards, it was at some kind of seminar or some kind of conference for youth marketing, and the guy said something like, anti-social behavior in pursuit of a product is a good thing.
Yes, he did say that.
Unflinchingly. So
yep.
I don't really think that this film has a protagonist. It's clear who the filmmakers think the antagonist is. Laissez-faire approach to, you know, dealing with this issue, basically personified through Reagan. But you reacted, Celestina, a little bit more strongly to all of this.
Yeah, this documentary made me pretty angry. And I think primarily because they were using a lot of the same tactics, the propaganda, like manipulation, the twisting of facts, the slanting of clips. They were using the same thing that they were criticizing in their own presentation, manipulating our emotions, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. But I started to think around that point, maybe these things, these laws that were in place, I hate to say this, I have a feeling like this is not going to go over well, but were not in a real way, not in a helpful way, but we're just kind of holding back the bad that does exist in that industry. Now, obviously, there's a much deeper problem there. Open the floodgates and all that bad can come out. It's just a symptom that there's a deeper problem in society about the respect for children, right?
Right.
If there's so many people who are just like being held back by this legal gate from preying on them, right? It does show that there's something deeper. But this documentary is just another example of something that we've talked about so frequently on the show, especially lately. In fact, in our last show, the show where we talked about Clockwork Orange, not dealing with the actual roots of the problem. Now, You guys tell me, do you think they at least made an attempt in this film to address the problem in a root way?
I didn't see any evidence of that.
It was total propaganda.
The only possible solution that they're interested in is having government violence make this problem go away.
And they were lying and twisting facts to get you to arrive at this conclusion, which it wasn't even, you know, getting you to arrive at a conclusion. They were pretty much laying it out for you.
Right.
And then using this like really these really flimsy supportive arguments, to support it.
Well, the other thing, too, is around the 20th, because like I have the 22 minute mark written in my notes. They do go to the schools.
As a child, you're competing with MBAs. You're competing with some of the smartest people out there.
In the face of these developments, many critics of youth marketing have called on schools to develop media literacy curricula to help kids navigate commercial culture. The results have sometimes been less than encouraging.
Now, a word from our sponsor.
That's how some schools are making extra money, literally selling themselves to advertisers.
Everything from the band shell.
That will be $125,000.
To the lecture hall.
$150,000.
Can be named for a price at New Berlin schools.
There's advertising on school walls, on school buses, and gymnasiums. There's donated scoreboards that have the Coca-Cola or the Pepsi logo on them.
There are so many ways that commercialism has intruded into our classrooms. There's Coke and Pepsi and Cadbury Schweppes in the schools, which are helping to generate an epidemic of childhood obesity among our kids across the country. There's school book covers. There are sponsored educational materials. There's a company called Field Trip Factory, which takes kids to places like Petco and to Sports Authority and calls that education.
The Chicago kindergartners are on a school field trip, but the animals they're going to see aren't in the zoo.
We want to welcome you to Petco.
Across the country, a growing number of schools are taking America's classrooms to America's malls.
And there's a new company called Bus Radio, which is trying to compel a million kids to listen to 8 minutes of advertisements per hour as they ride the school bus.
BusRadio.com. We'll choose a name at random, and if you're the winner, we'll give a pair of tickets to your bus driver, too. You guys can hang out together, maybe share a large Coke. Email us as soon as you get home.
There's Channel One, which compels about 7 million children to watch ads in schools each school day.
Today on Channel One.
The purpose of schools, in part, is to promote reason. And the purpose of advertising is to subvert reason, to promote the sale of a product. And for that reason alone, advertising has no proper place in the schools.
It's not a new thing either. Like they talked in the movie about Channel One,
oh, yeah.
Right? Channel One, where they would put a TV in every classroom and the kids during homeroom in the morning have to watch it.
Yeah.
And it's mostly commercials. That's not new. We had that when I was in high school in the early 90s. Yeah.
Yeah.
They also talked about watching kids in showers, like, to see...
Yeah.
Could that be true? Like, they talked about observing children taking baths in showers to see how
and
they
pooping.
Interact. Yeah, and pooping, really? I must have missed that.
Yeah, they showed a kid, like, sitting there on the toilet with, like, an adult standing nearby with a clipboard.
Was that staged, or...?
Probably.
Now, I want to be clear. Like, I think it's a comfortable place to attack the progressive agenda of this film, right? And I'm not accusing any of us of this, but it's an easy cop-out for people sometimes to say, well, the market will take care of these things. That seems to be a go-to position.
But that's never really my response to any of that.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that it's a relatively common retreat for a lot of people when these issues come up. I really think that a lot of these child marketing practices and these child advertising practices are really horrifying, really, really disgusting. I think it's important to point that out up front.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do really want to get into the real issue of why this is wrong, but
sure.
I just kind of want to get out there. Like, the idea of regulating this, like, I'm not sure how it was regulated in the past or how it could possibly be regulated in the future. Like, it would be so subjective. And it would just be a tool for businesses to attack rival businesses. Like, I don't think that this would have any effect, any positive change for children if this happened. This would just be like another political tool if we regulated it.
Right.
Where you mean like somebody would get to be the biggest marketing company, or there would be already marketing firms and advertising firms that have a lot of power in Washington, let's say, so that whatever regulations were put in place by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, could just be used to stop competition.
Yeah, like whoever has a better, more expensive lawyer could go after, you know, other corporations or smaller businesses and say, you know, it's not really like blatant, but this seems to be targeting children, this ad. I feel like because of this, that, and the other thing that this ad is targeting children, let's shut it down.
Yeah.
Or would you have to submit all your ads and ad copy through this government agency for them to approve it? And then it becomes a, you know, whoever greases the most wheels at that agency gets their stuff approved faster. They're not losing money with products sitting in warehouses that they can't advertise, for example.
People might lobby for more specific laws, more specific legislation about it.
I think people will always do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're at this point where if we follow their story,
mm-hmm.
in the early 80s, the floodgates open.
Right.
And
there's a lot of evidence of it sort of trickling in before that. Like, because in the 70s, that's when McDonald's came up with all their characters, like Ronald McDonald and Grimace and Happy Meals.
How could any of that stuff, by the way, attract children? Ronald McDonald, the Burger King, he is like the scariest dude ever. You ever see those commercials where he just like pops out from behind a wall?
Yeah, where like somebody turns over and he's like lying in their bed with that like frozen plastic smile on his face?
Yeah, and
that is the stuff of nightmares.
But I think the Burger King is a parody. The Burger King is something for adults.
The way they've been doing the Burger King commercials the last few years does make it seem like more of a parody of those things.
Yeah,
like,
but he's creepy as hell.
They acknowledge in the commercials, though, that he's creepy. He's always creeping around and, you know, turning up, standing right behind you.
What I was trying to speak to with the Burger King, there is an appeal to adults for that, right? And that speaks to how much psychological research actually goes into connecting somebody back to a younger time in their life where fast food was exciting.
And you weren't really made to feel guilty about eating it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're using this creepy mascot, right? Unrealistic representation that is so over the top that as an adult you have to notice it. And of course it's weird and it's scary, but it brings you back to that time where mascots sold products to you.
It's not just children that mascots sell stuff to. Like, look at something like Aflac with the talking duck. It's an insurance company. It's got a cute animal mascot that does funny things in the commercials.
Yeah, but see, it's kind of like pulling in both ways. Like, I'm talking about advertising trying to make people feel younger, and then they talk in the movie about how advertising, in a lot of these cases with very young kids, sometimes kids as young as five, it's trying to make them feel older. Yeah, like tweens used to be around 12.
Kids want to feel. They want to feel like they're being respected.
Yeah, and now it goes down. Like tween goes down to
six, maybe four in the next couple of years.
Yeah,
and that's one point they made in the documentary that I absolutely agree with. Like the notion that a 6 year old is no longer a child, but is a preteen.
Mm.
Like that's what tweens used to be called, right? Preteens.
Yeah,
and now they had to make up a new word because now it doesn't have to mean anything. They can just keep moving the goalposts on how old tweens are. 6 to 12.
Well, I don't think, I don't think even when I was a little kid, like a advertisement made me think that the food was going to taste better than it actually was. What would get me is toys.
Yep.
In like, say, Happy Meals. Like I would eat a McDonald's over a Burger King because it had the Transformers in it or whatever.
Good.
It's not even really
even as an adult. We've gone after toys from, or usually like collectible glasses or something. Who does at McDonald's, I remember.
When you say even as an adult, and you mentioned Aflac before.
Yes.
It makes me think about something that they talked about right at the beginning of the documentary, which was not purchasing power, which kids have basically none of, right? But what they do have is purchasing influence.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that well, there's this larger childification or infantilization of the whole society. It certainly, this goes back to what I was saying about it pulling in both directions, bringing people, making people older, but also, you know, trying to have adult things appeal to a younger crowd, like the Toyota Sienna commercial that's filled with a girl brought it to school for show and tell.
Right.
Right. So they talk about, I think they said kids influence $700 billion a year.
They did say that.
And, you know, that's a number.
What does that even mean? Like, you know, does that mean if you have children, you're going to buy a minivan instead of a Mini Cooper, right?
Yeah. Like, I don't really know that they need to sell the concept of the minivan in general to parents.
Parents are pretty much
resigned to it.
Yeah.
But is that where the kids' purchasing power lies?
Purchasing influence?
Purchasing influence.
Some of it, yeah.
And even putting psychological research into how many times can we get a kid to ask for something. I mean, I believe all of that is real. And when you see how long psychology has been used, right, it's always like the worst people always have this stuff first.
Yeah.
You know, the technology that can shape and change the world is always used first to control people, usually without them even knowing it.
Yes.
To control and monitor people. And when we look at the things, you know, I don't mean to be cynical, but when we look at the things that we have access to today, technologically, it's scary to think about when the NSA had access to this stuff to be used against us. But psychology and neuroscience in general, this is something that, you know, I don't put a lot of stock in Freud, but if he did good work on anything, I would say it is the unconscious and how to tap into unconscious desire to get people to do things.
Yeah. Was it Barney was just I think one of the first like pure products of focus testing. Like they tested and tested and everything about that show from The Color Purple to repetition, like kids like repetition, like let's do that again. Everything was a product of focus testing. They, you know, there was like no artistic value in it at all. It was just what will make kids watch this over and over and over again.
And they made up this and they had this whole fake story about how Barney was invented that they made up.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to put that on the back of the toy. Barney is the result of intensive focus testing. I love you.
it's hard to like look at it as an adult, and especially as a parent who's kind of in the dark on a lot of this stuff, mm-hmm. and not understand the amount of, you know, resources and minds and money that go into crafting a program that has, you know, that's affecting somebody probably on a subconscious level. But one of the things that I found most interesting is that all the tricks that they're talking about mm-hmm. in this film that are being applied to kids are the same tricks that adults have been falling for decades in advertising.
Yeah, and kids aren't even as smart as adults. Well, yeah. They're not as sophisticated as adults.
I think
generally
they probably don't. They don't understand as much just from the lack of experience. They don't understand as much about certainly television that, you know, everything that comes, you know, into their sensory uptake out of the television is entertainment.
Yeah. Children below 30 months can't even distinguish the difference between fiction and reality.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, maybe the thing about repetition for young children, why they like it so much, is maybe it's a learning tool. Maybe their brains are designed that way at that age because repetition will help them, you know, instill knowledge. And, you know, if that's the case, then these people who are doing, you know, these shows and these targeted advertising, you know, the shows with, like, repetition and everything, they're using that development tool that children are equipped with.
It is a fact that kids love repetition.
Yeah.
A 2-year-old, you do something funny, what's the first word they're going to say? Again. Again.
Yeah.
Or they'll watch the same movie every day, sometimes multiple times per day.
Well, I think it's the predictability that, you know, when you're trying so hard to make sense of the world around you, mm-hmm. having – there's a comfort in predictability versus, you know, having all different kinds of things – thrown at you. And right. I think that maybe even into elementary school, one of the reasons why we see so little like overt rebellion in school, which must just suck so much when you're 6 and you walk in there and it's like, okay, well now all day you sit in a desk.
Yeah.
You know, but the repetition, the programming, the routine of it might be, I don't want to say soothing because that sounds too positive, but like numbing, relaxing, sedating, you know, because there's a comfort in that. I don't think it's about, I love repetition.
What I'm trying to say is, like, if it is a learning tool for a child to want to hear things over and over, then these marketers are using, you know, that to just fill kids' head with shit.
Programming tool.
The joy of experiencing the same thing over and over is possibly, and we don't know, no, we already established
we're
not neurologists.
Sure.
But that may be an important developmental tool that children have that they're born with. The ability to withstand repetitions are the same thing, I should even say.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that's the thing I've been worried about. Like, looking at the way kids are growing up nowadays, I look at my nieces, like, their attention span is just – it's upsetting to see how little attention span they have. They can't go for a 5-minute car ride without watching a DVD in the car.
And this is where the movie won me over a little bit more. Because they address all that as well. So it's not like they're completely unwilling to get – close to issues that I identify with, mm-hmm. issues that I think are important. I would say that in addition to, you know, school being so boring that some kids get to this point, like we are seeing younger and younger kids being diagnosed with, you know, ADHD, ADD, bipolar disorder than ever before. But that was something that nobody was talking about 10, 15 years ago. No, hardly anyone was talking about that under middle school age, where a kid might, you know, start right. to feel a little bit more like an adult and say, okay, now is the time to push back. So we would see it in middle school. We would see it in high school when Frontline did that medicated child. I'm thinking that was 15 years ago. They were putting a spotlight on what was at that time relatively rare cases where a 9-year-old mm-hmm. would be diagnosed bipolar or ADHD. But, you know, this film, it does address a lot of things that I think are important, like diet, medication.
Right. But I have to wonder, though, because they definitely try to make the case in the show that all these diagnoses of ADHD or bipolar disorder in younger and younger children are an effect of advertising, you know, and it's possible, I guess, but I think it's more of a change in the way psychiatric drugs are prescribed. It's about changes in diagnostic criteria.
It's a confluence.
Yeah.
And then you have the thing too, like school hasn't changed, right? When we were in elementary school and middle school, it's pretty much exactly the same today.
Right.
You know,
there's a lot more metal detectors now.
Yeah, there's a lot more. Yeah, it's gotten worse. But as far as the pedagogy or the environment, very, very little is different.
Right.
So outside of school, we would play little sparts or watch a little TV. And I mean a little TV, you know, literally a little TV. And
like a 12-inch black and white set.
19 inches was enormous TV.
It was.
A little TV as far as choice, too. You weren't inundated with all of these different options. There was very clear delineation between television programming and commercials. When I grew up, there was no Nickelodeon. So it wasn't like there was some cartoon, cut to a commercial, more cartoon, more of all the same colors, all of the same characters. There was a difference. We had to do a lot more, I think, to entertain ourselves. Where even today as adults, like if we were an adult in 1985, my goodness, what would you do? You know?
Talk to people.
Go outside.
We certainly wouldn't be doing a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We would be recording our podcasts on cassette and then handing them out to people.
But so now there's this real clear difference between like, yeah, school sucks. School's boring. It's the same. There's, you know, you go in, you sit there all day, you suffer through it. But outside of school, for these kids, it's like a goddamn amusement park all day, all directions with all this different stimulation. So kids today, not just from the television, but from other media as well,
right,
they are hyper-stimulated and they're going into school where they're being forced to do the same things that maybe was a lot easier for us to do 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, or 25 years ago, 30 years ago. Sit still. Because there weren't as – it wasn't such a amazing difference from in school and outside of school. It was definitely a difference. Like outside of school, we were free. We could have fun. We could use our imaginations. We could explore.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily the result of kids having too much stimulation in the forms of different kinds of media. I think it's mostly due to the fact that kids aren't allowed to do anything anymore.
That's true.
What are they going to do? I mean, other than like play video games and get on Facebook, they can't actually like go out and play in the streets like we did when we were kids. You know, you can't like kids go on a bike ride far away. You know, these are things we were doing when we were pretty little. And, you know, there's just so much legislation about what constitutes neglect now that kids, like, what can they do except hang out in their room and, you know, use media?
Yeah. Right. I mean, kids' schedules today are kids are booked from the time they wake up in the morning to the time they go to bed at night. Kids don't have unstructured time anymore.
Yeah, that too.
It's considered irresponsible parenting to leave your kids to their own devices. I read a news story a couple months ago about a boy who rode his bike a mile to the field where his soccer practice was, and somebody called the police because there was a kid outside riding his bike by himself.
Who is the worst mother in the world? Did she let her kid ride? He was like 10 or something. She let him ride the subway by himself, and she was dubbed by the media the worst mother in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe the kid was younger. But,
you know, I don't know that it really even matters. I mean, what did kids do? Kids who live in New York City got to get to school somehow.
Yeah.
Young kids ride the subway every day by themselves.
I think this is also a product of the media. As technology has expanded, all of these things are more available, and they're available in greater volume. So maybe they were using the same tactics on us when we were kids as far as the psychological components of advertising and marketing. But there was just so little of it because there were just so few outlets to put it through, you know what I mean? Or so many channels to put it through.
Mm-hmm.
As far as news, like maybe all the same bad stuff that everybody's so afraid of today, you know, it existed then.
Yeah.
You just weren't having it thrown in your face 24 hours a day.
Well, I mean, you know, people talk about how there's like I've heard people actually say that there's more dangerous people out there than there used to be. Like there's more pedophiles than there used to be. But the thing is, I think there were just as many pedophiles around years ago. It's just nobody ever talked about it. You certainly couldn't go to a website to find a list of known pedophiles.
Right. And the truth is that there's probably less people, like as far as per capita,
mm-hmm.
there might be in number more because there's more people, but per capita in the population, there's probably less. Because I know if I was a pedophile, it's a hard thing to even imagine. I mean, but, you know, if I had, and I understand, I can't put myself into the shoes and say, you know, if I was really thinking about what would make sense. Because I understand that it's a compulsion that circumvents logic, not to defend them or sympathize with them or anything like that. But I can't put myself in the shoes of a pedophile. But I would think that a lot more of these people are probably at home, you know, and you get these cartoons from Japan, you know, or like we, I've seen kids who had, you know, sexually reactive behavior issues and how minimal the stimuli needed to be to get a very strong sexual response from things. Mm. So when that appetite could have been satiated by looking at the boys' underwear section from the Sears catalog or something, mm-hmm. today they just have an endless selection if you know where to find it. You know, like I've never been on the internet in my life and like clicked on something and been like, uh-oh, child porn. Like I've never seen it, but it's certainly – there's a huge market for it and it's out there. Mm-hmm. And if you're resourceful enough to – you know, physically abuse a child in such a terrible way with like trickery and candy or, you know, lying or however they do it.
A really nice van.
Yeah. You're certainly resourceful enough to find porn that isn't just readily available through a Google search. So I would think that more of those people are probably not on the street today, for at least not stalking the streets.
They're at home in front of their computers.
Yeah.
Because they have an outlet for their desires. Like, you know, maybe back in the day, you know, if you were a pedophile, you'd have to like go find a little boy to get your pedophilia on. Now you just have to turn on your computer.
Yeah. And this might be true. And I think the same thing is true for younger kids with violent entertainment or violent video games, that it's not an inspiration as much as it's an outlet.
Mm.
And like we talked about in the Clockwork Orange show, if all it takes is like Mortal Kombat or Grand Theft Auto to get a 15-year-old kid to go out there and murder somebody, and that's a widespread problem,
right?
Your society has a deeper sickness than just the exposure to video games, you know, what's available to kids and teenagers. Right. You know, like there's a deeper issue that's not being explored if that's all that it takes to inspire somebody to do some kind of horrific act.
Right. And clearly that's not all it takes. I mean, there's a, you know, this incredibly huge excluded middle in that whole argument is, you know, the millions of people who play violent video games every day who never commit an act of violence against anyone.
Yeah, it's the exception to the rule.
What about all the people who have read the Bible and committed acts of violence? You know, hundreds of thousands of people have read the Bible and committed acts of violence. You know,
we should do a PSA about that.
we don't say that, you know, the Bible leads to violence when there's such a bigger percentage of people who have been led to violence because of the Bible.
Right.
And that was Anthony Burgess's defense of A Clockwork Orange, too. You know, he drew that comparison to the Bible.
Well, that's a worthwhile comparison.
So you see that all of this sickness exists, right? That's mostly psychological and it's deeper. And these little channels through which it can come out always winds up being blamed as the actual problem. So there was this quote that I kind of stumbled upon by accident. I don't think it was in the documentary. I don't remember where I saw it, but W.E.B. Du Bois, do you know who that is?
I've heard the name.
An African, influential African-American figure throughout like the 1920s, 1930s. He said, children learn more from what you are than from what you teach.
Well, yeah.
But wait. What about do as I say, not as I do?
Ah, that's a thing that adults like to say.
Yeah, isn't that?
That's after the kids learned. But that's something that the adults say after you've already learned from what they are and not what they taught.
Right. Hypocrisy is a real thing, so they have to learn about it sometime.
Right.
A lot of the stuff that was pointed out in Consuming Kids, they talked about these advertisers trying to, and again, like this was the disingenuous part of it, that they started this in the 80s, which was so not the real story, using products or suggesting that products define you as an individual, that these products have this cool factor.
You are what you buy.
You are what you buy.
Somebody claimed that was a common saying.
You are what
I've never heard that in my life.
You are what you own, right. Which I've also never heard.
Well, I heard that one in Fight Club.
But that self-esteem is something that's, you know, provisional. And it comes from what you have. But all of that stuff that was what was done to adults as early as the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And this was a very active campaign. I mentioned Freud earlier in the show. Have you guys ever heard of his nephew? Edward Bernays.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So Edward Bernays was called the father of public relations. The first thing that Edward Bernays did that was noteworthy, he was a member of the Committee on Public Information in the Woodrow Wilson administration during World War I. So if you're unfamiliar, audience, the Committee on Public Information was basically a group of propagandists that sold World War I to a society that was not interested in foreign interventions and honestly pretty pacifist getting them excited about the idea of the United States participating in a war that really had nothing to do with the United States in Europe. And there's a great documentary about this that I really recommend, at least watching the first part. It's called The Century of the Self. It's by a British filmmaker who's also a lefty named Adam Curtis, but he does very good work. And he actually has interview footage of Bernays from the 80s, who is about, you know, as, you know, ashamed of what he did or what he was involved in as that woman that we saw that – and I'll play a clip of this in the podcast, the blonde woman who says, well, is this ethical or not? I don't know, but it's good for us.
Yeah,
it's good for
money.
Me. Yeah.
I was in Paris for the entire – time of the peace conference that was held in the suburb of Paris, and we worked to make the world safe for democracy. That was a big slogan.
Wilson's reception in Paris astounded Bernays and the other American propagandists. Their propaganda had portrayed Wilson as a liberator of the people, a man who would create a new world in which the individual would be free. They had made him a hero of the masses. And as he watched the crowd surge around Wilson, Bernays began to wonder whether it would be possible to do the same type of mass persuasion, but in peacetime.
When I came back to the United States, I decided that if you could use propaganda for war, you could certainly use it for peace. And propaganda got to be a bad word because of the Germans using it. So what I did was to try to find some other words. So we found the word Council on Public Relations.
And after that, after Wilson was no longer president, he went to work for corporations. And what he was trying to apply to the world of advertising and marketing was Sigmund Freud's very, very cynical view of mankind as an irrational creature that is completely controlled by emotion. What he did was he used things that I really think people understood, certain people understood for centuries, if not for thousands of years. For how, if you want people to make decisions that benefit you, even if those decisions run in direct opposition to what's in their best interest, you have to take them out of the realm of thinking logically and get them to think emotionally.
Right.
Right. So, for example, if your interest is I need soldiers to expand my kingdom, and the other person's interest is to stay alive, right? You don't say, well, geez, you know, if I had more land, I could get more resources, and then I could have better silverware in my palace. It doesn't work with somebody who you're asking to die. But if you
all you have to do is offer to pay for college.
Well, or if you create, or you know, it's always a different thing at a different time. Maybe that's what it is today. Yeah,
you create a narrative that where this war benefit going to war and maybe getting their limb shot off benefits them somehow.
Yeah, and it's at one point it was just as simple as nationalism, right? This that your identity doesn't come through, you know, maybe a product or owning something like they claim in this film today, mm-hmm. but your identity comes through belonging to this collective, you know, that's who you are, that the two are inseparable. You're nothing right. without us. So this is something that had been in practice for I would pretty much say with religion, especially since the beginning of time,
mm-hmm.
since the beginning of civilization, manipulating people's emotions, especially their fears. I mean, I think that's the idea of religion itself. Right?
Oh, yeah.
The hopefulness of eternal salvation versus the fear of eternal damnation.
And then you can just ban anything. If you say, if you do this, you'll go to hell, then you can forbid people to do anything at all, and they'll obey.
In any of these things, whether it's the government or corporations, and I'm not making much a distinction between the two as far as some of their tactics are concerned, but you don't sell. Whatever you're selling, it does not – you're not talking to a person's intellect when you do it. Freud – ultimately wound up being used by Bernays. What he was doing in Austria, which mm-hmm. is in Central Europe, which is a place we've talked about a lot.
Austria. I feel like that's come up before.
Yeah, on my show.
Maybe.
When Freud was most active there, what he was doing was extremely unpopular because he was saying that we could – it might be possible. I don't think he had the malevolence. I think he just kind of was very cynical about – human beings
yes.
and what he saw. And I think he lived during World War I, so he felt like he was vindicated in a lot of his cynicism about mankind. I was like, oh, this is like the most irrational thing that people could ever do. You know, and I'm watching it happen. I'm right in the middle of it happening. But it was very unpopular because what he was asking people to do in these very rigid, very obedient, very conformist societies that ultimately, you know, became the Austro-Hungarian Empire and eventually in a slightly different place, Nazi Germany, he was asking people to examine their feelings, to go inside themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the people in power saw this practice, saw the call to do this as like a real threat.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
But at the same time, he was applying like very rigid meanings to what you saw inside.
That's also true.
I've called him on my show quack before.
Yeah, because he's a quack.
But I think that if there was some good that came out of his existence and his work, he was kind of a pioneer in the idea. I mean, he wasn't the first person ever to mention it, even though he might have been the first person to use the terminology that I know of anyway. I mean, maybe trying to understand some of this stuff goes back to Socrates. The unexamined life is not worth living. But you could say that he did make a positive contribution to this field just in that respect, just in pointing out the importance of a lot goes on in the subconscious, you know, a lot stored there that kind of slips by the conscious mind.
I don't think he was the first one to come up with that.
No. I'm saying
he just popularized it.
He popularized it. And honestly,
and then it was weaponized.
Yeah. I mean, I find it really interesting that all of like modern psychology most of modern psychology is based on, you know, a guy who did a bunch of cocaine and made a lot of shit up. And then, you know, all of public relations is based on, you know, his nephew and the teachings. I don't think I realized that he was his nephew. And I just find this really interesting. So that all of, you know, public relations is basically based on what his nephew came up with based on Freud's teachings. I find it fascinating what a screwed up world we live in.
And yes, you're right that maybe he only popularized something that was discussed in volumes before. But I would say that the only reason we've ever even heard of Freud was because of who his nephew was and what his nephew did.
Oh, right. Now I remember. I remember we talked about this before.
Yeah, because Freud's work existed only in Austria and was kind of like for public consumption, which is why I think there was so much fear generated about what its impact on society could be. But when Bernays brought it to America, it was not for the public benefit. Like this is like how we, the public, get the residuals later on of psychology and today technology. So the idea of people going to be analyzed was something that came after Bernays had been in business in the United States helping government and corporations for decades. You know, then it opened up to the people like, oh, this is, you know, here, you can have a little of this, too. We've already used it on you in ways that you can't even understand. But yeah, I think that the only reason we've ever heard of Freud is because of Bernays, even though most people have never heard of Bernays, but they've all heard of Freud.
Well, I guess Bernays doesn't make a good character in a cartoon or a comedy movie.
Because
Freud keeps turning up because he got that distinctive look.
Yeah, no one's going back in a telephone booth to pick up Bernays. With Beethoven and Socrates. So we will take some calls on this topic if anyone wants to call in and join this conversation or if anyone has some thoughts that they would like to put in the chat related to this topic or any aspect of this topic that we've covered tonight. If you have something that you want me to read on the show, I can do that. Someone in the chat asks, what about the parents' responsibility in not only giving their children an understanding of marketing, but also protecting them from it?
Oh, yeah. Good point. According to this documentary, we understand that, you know, as parents, you can't do everything. So we're here to help. We're here to ask the government to help.
Right.
Really. Because, you know, you can't
raise your kids on your own.
You can't do it by yourself.
You can't raise your own children.
And it took that completely, like, condescending attitude towards it.
Now, being a parent is certainly hard work, and I'm sure at times it can be overwhelming. And I think a lot of people are finding relief in those moments where the kid will entertain his or herself.
Or will be entertained by a passive device.
Exactly. A lot of parents just aren't really wise to this. the amount of thought and resources that have gone into, you know, attacking children. I don't want to say attacking, but communicating with children on a subconscious level for ends that are not in the kid's best interest. But you're right, Celestina, the film definitely shifts a lot of the responsibility. It doesn't, I don't think it takes all the responsibility away. It kind of makes it like it takes a village kind of shit, right?
Yeah, but it's not. It takes a village. It takes you and the government. That's what it takes to raise your children.
That was definitely the impression that was given.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah. And I say it takes a village is kind of like a euphemism because Hillary Clinton said it and she meant it, the government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. They did understand in the film that that would be a logical pushback as a criticism of the film, that people would say, well, isn't this the parents' responsibility? And I think it really comes down to, just from my own experience, this is something that I've talked about on the show before, even though I always say I am not a parent, but being proactive in that respect can make a big difference.
Yeah, and it's not so much just keeping your kids away from this stuff, but explaining to them what, like, how they're targeting you and, you know, how they're trying to manipulate your emotions so they can understand it. I mean, you can't just, like, take all the technology away from children. This is the world that they live in. And when they're adults, it's going to be even more so,
right?
You know, where everything is just going to be integrated into technology. So, I mean, what do? You make your kid a troglodyte? So,
well, the other problem is that how are you as a parent supposed to educate your children about how advertising is misleading and, you know, you're being lied to when you're most people, most adults aren't even cognizant of that themselves.
Yeah,
absolutely. So there's a lot of sitting ducks. And I've talked about school before as this goose that keeps laying golden eggs mm-hmm. year after year for corporations, for marketers, for the state, for the military, for bureaucracies, because it makes people who are, I don't want to say they're thoughtless and obedient, but they're certainly not exercising the tools that they have to defend themselves intellectually from this onslaught, which even as an right. adult is coming at you in several directions. Now, if you're a teenager, there's targets all over you, and maybe younger kids as well. But Sam in the chat said that her kid can watch all the Bill Nye and Mythbusters that kid wants without any commercials. And that and I'm not sure if this is what she meant or not, but that comes down to being proactive as well and planning right. ahead. There's ways that you can obtain all kinds of entertainment for your children that is absolutely commercial free, and you can also preview that entertainment
right.
to see, well, are there overt messages, like just at a quick pass through, at a quick glance of this, can I detect that this is something like a lot of the shows that they criticized for kids in the 1980s, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and He-Man and G.I. Joe, which basically, or in the 90s, Pokemon, which basically right. just existed for the purpose of selling those kids toys.
I mean, the tagline is gotta catch them all, right?
Yeah. Yeah, all of the things that I think maybe were emerging to the 80s, if not before that. And I do agree that once that, like I said before, once that door opened, all of this stuff could pour out and become a little bit more visible, that maybe the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, was putting this arbitrary or legal cap on what marketers could do. It doesn't mean that the problem didn't exist just as fully formed beneath the surface. You know, where everyone right. couldn't see it. I know we've harped on this a little bit, but it was certainly insincere for them to make it sound like that was the origin of a problem. That is something that, I mean, kids have been abused for thousands of years.
Well, that's how we deal with every problem. Like any problem in our society, we figure out what to blame it on, and we blame it on that thing, whether it makes any sense or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they mentioned, you know, the quote by Lucas where he said, "I'm not a filmmaker, I'm a toy maker," or something like that, right?
Yeah, like, that was, like, heinously out of context.
Yeah, what was that about?
He was actually asked in this was around, I remember this interview was in Starlog magazine, which was the only place in the 80s that you could get any information about upcoming science fiction films. It was very exciting. Now we have the internet. But there was an interview with him, and I remember the photo that accompanied it. It was just him surrounded by, like, mountains of Star Wars merchandise. And when he said, "I'm not a filmmaker, I'm a toy maker," he was expressing a regret.
Yeah.
That, right. you know, so much of his energy, like, he had to personally approve every Star Wars product, and which makes you wonder, like, if he's so disappointed in the quality of a lot of those products, why did he approve them?
Yeah.
But, you know, it was more, he spent more time, like, dealing with merchandising concerns than he did working on films.
Yeah, but, I mean, then when you come to something like Episode One, and you take that statement, like, he, that...
Yeah, well, definitely.
He was a toy maker. I mean, why would you have something like Jar Jar Binks in a movie if it weren't for the purpose of making toys? So maybe he had some regret back then, and then he became a hack.
Well, he might have been a hack all along.
Yeah.
I strongly suspect that he was, but he had a veneer of not being a hack pretty early on.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, Corey, you were saying earlier about how your nieces can't go a car ride without watching a DVD. And I was wondering, like, when they're on a car ride, are their parents engaging them or are they just talking to each other?
No, they're just
sitting in the back seat.
They're just talking to each other.
Yeah, so that's probably why they can't go without a DVD.
Right. I mean, they have separate DVD players. Like, there's a DVD player for each kid in the car, built into the car, and the screens are in the headrest. In front of them, like, and they each watch their own thing.
So it's pretty obvious that, you know, car time is a time when mommy and daddy talk to each other.
Yes.
Let's take a call. Hi, this is School Sucks. You're on the show. All right, let's try that.
Okay, here we go. Earlier you mentioned the mom that was coined worst mom in the world because she let her son ride the subway.
Yep.
And that's Lenore Skenazy.
Yes.
She has a blog, Free Range Kids.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She talks a lot about children being allowed to have autonomy. And they're like, you know, I'm going to the park. So that's a really good event that she's got going, and she has a good blog. And then the other thing was about repetition in children. And they do learn through repetition for sure. But I think it's like when parents are repeating a story or reading a story or, you know, repetition in their life, but maybe not necessarily watching Barney. So because they're little scientists, they're figuring out differences in how something is done each time. But I'm sure that that's used in a negative way as far as marketing for children.
Right. So, yeah, that's kind of what I was saying. Like, maybe they have this natural way of learning. And it's being exploited, basically, by these, like, TV shows and these advertisers.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think the whole thing ties in, too, with Lenore's idea of getting children outside and playing with other children. And, you know, the 24-hour news cycle scaring us into keeping our children more plugged in at home just adds into more time there in front of the screen, more time to learn about all the things that they're going to want or think they need. So I think it all ties in nicely.
Right.
As far as the subject.
Have you ever seen this documentary?
I watched part of it, and I had to turn it off.
Really?
You had? Yeah. I don't know. I tried to watch some of it, and I felt like where it was steering me was bothering me a little. I found it horrifying what's being done to children, but I was horrified just as much by the solutions.
Yeah, exactly.
And you feel like that comes through pretty clearly in this film, that this is just simply a call for more government?
Definitely, definitely. And, I didn't watch a whole lot of it either.
Yeah.
It's pretty immediate, I think. It was a while ago I saw it.
I don't mind, because, you know, a lot of these documentaries, I'll watch a whole documentary like that, because I do still think that you can mine some useful things out of it. And even if you can't walk away with it or walk away from it with any exceptionally useful new information, it at least gets that thought process going. It's like kind of the same reason why I don't mind watching the Bill Maher show, because it gets my wheels turning.
I agree. I think you can definitely at least get the thought process going, whether or not what's for the solution is what you're looking for or would accept. But I agree with that for sure.
Because a lot of the problems that are identified by these people with these really horrifying solutions are, you know, real problems. And certainly it's a great disservice to children to suggest such a, you know, oversimplified solution to a complex problem. I wonder who's behind this documentary, because I saw a film years ago when I was a real liberal myself, and it was called Orwell Rolls in His Grave, ironically, and it was about the media. And it suggested in the film that the media was controlled by conservative interests. This was made during the presidency of George W. Bush. Now, this the good lesson to take away from this, even though this is a slightly different subject, is that the media is controlled by state interests. And there was a time, you know, the time when the documentary was made, where a big part of the state was the Bush administration. So it talks about all of these, like right down to MSNBC, that were all rah-rah for the Iraq war, the New York Times, CNN. Everybody was on the same page about that. And it wasn't until all those boots were already on the ground in that country and most of the damage had already been done that it seemed like the mainstream media received the signal that is, okay, now you can start asking questions. Now you can start criticizing Bush's policy. But when it was the lead up to that war, there were very, very few dissenting voices. And the same is true with Vietnam. It was actually pointed out in a film called Why We Fight by Eugene Jarecki, where it talks about how there was just this lone voice here and there. Orwell rolls in his grave. There... thing was where everything went downhill was when the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, also by Reagan. And I think that the common factor is that these are people who have little to no faith in ordinary people's ability to solve problems and defend themselves intellectually from predators. So it's just like, you're helpless. You need people like us and the people that we cheer for in the bureaucracies that we want to create to protect you from predators. Do not stop do not try to trust your mind to defend yourself. So I wonder if these documentary films came from similar origins, because that seemed to be the message of that your kids are defenseless. You can't protect them. You need the help of the state to do that.
Right. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest problems I have with this is that, I mean, if this isn't for just some political agenda, like, we live in a world where child abuse is legal, right? And these people are saying, you know, we need to give the FTC more power so they could regulate children's programming and advertising because it's, like, potentially dangerous. Like, what about, you know, legislating what is already a natural law? Like, does anybody even talk about that? Like, a beating your children. Like, nobody's even talking about that. And yet we're talking about all these things that are potentially damaging to children when assault on children is still legal. Like, I can't see that these people could possibly be genuine. And another thing is, like, you know, when you have, a true idea, you don't need to use anything but truth to get your point across. And there were so many places where I saw truth being twisted and manipulation of facts for them to try to get their point across. Like, I just can't really believe that this isn't anything other than political agenda. Or it's, you know, misguided people who have heard something and are regurgitating it in a really poor way.
I think it could be as simple as, you know, just being blind to the actual issue. Like, it just occurred to me that you ever, especially if you don't have kids, try giving someone advice on how to raise their children. Right? But apparently there's an exemption to that rule that you can't tell other people how to raise their kids. And the only way to be exempt from that rule is to be working for the government.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've tried. It's like, we kind of got into that a little bit just the other night with my brother. We all had Christmas together.
Yep.
And we talked to I questioned my brother about the word discipline. And I was satisfied with his response. You know, I think he was talking more about self-discipline than actually, you know, he says people hear the word discipline and they automatically assume that it's like beating on your kids. And
right.
When he explained, he was actually talking about is teaching your kids discipline, which is like a completely different thing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And which is an important lesson for sure. So, but yeah, it is like the reason why I bring that up is because it just brings back this memory. It's like this real uncomfortable feeling that is very, very palpable as soon as you're talking to somebody else in a way that can even be perceived as critical to somebody else about their parenting, about their kids. It's a very difficult subject to broach with people.
Right, even sure, when they bring a toddler into a horror movie.
And even if you're doing something differently as a parent to another parent, just the act of doing it differently is a threat to that person sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. Now, how's that gone for you? Because you must interact with people who are doing things very differently than you, Sarah.
Yeah, definitely. It's a challenge. It's we're learning from it, and trying to understand that and trying to have empathy for them, people that are doing it differently and looking at us and, you know, seeing it as threatening. This person that they thought they knew is suddenly completely doing things, so many things differently, for sure.
Right. Well, anything else before we let you go? I think you are going to be our last call of the night, and from now on, we're just going to interact. Yeah, we're going to interact with people through the chat if possible, because yeah, there is some phone connection issue that we're going to have to work out, and I'm thinking that it's on my end.
No, that's all. I just really wanted to mention Lenore Skenazy because I really like her blog. I think she does a really good job of helping people not be so afraid to trust their kids. And trust the world that it is safer than it ever has been.
Does she talk about, I mean, how to balance that with, being afraid of the law of like, parents getting charged with neglect and everything?
Well, she has had people reach out, or she's had stories about parents that have gotten in trouble for letting their children play alone outside.
Right.
So, her answer is really just that we all need to do more of that so that it's more normalized.
Right.
You know, when your kid is the only kid playing at the park alone, it's dangerous. But if the whole neighborhood plays together at the park, you know, it's safer, and nobody's going to call the cops on all the parents. So,
right, good point.
But it's a little crazy to think that happens because, I mean, we played outside when we were little and...
We did a lot of things when we were little that we're not allowed to, kids aren't allowed to do today.
Yeah, I never once in my life wore a bike helmet.
No.
Right. Yeah. So check her out. She's very interesting. And, she talks about the 24-hour news cycle and how that affects our parenting and our perception of safety. And, I think that really does add to the bigger picture of people not really understanding how to assess risk, which affects us all.
Absolutely.
When children never really learn that skill, they never flex that muscle. That affects so many things about the way we all live.
Yeah.
No.
And it kind of, it kind of puts adults into this false panic as well. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for calling and participating, and of course for all your support. We'll have to. I'd love to have you on the show again sometime in the future, where we have a good connection and we can talk for a while. And
sure. Okay. Thanks, Brett.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye. Corey, anything going on in the chat?
I have people saying that where they live, kids are legally required to wear bike helmets, which I think is pretty much the case everywhere these days.
I was actually detained briefly in Massachusetts as quite the adult, 30 years old, for not having a bike helmet on.
He also goes on to say that he would make his child wear a bike helmet anyway. He just doesn't need a gun to his head in order to...
Oh, come on. It's only... The gun only goes to your head at the very end.
And that's only if you refuse to be put in the cage.
And they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university where they are put in boxes, and they come out all the same. On the hillside, little boxes, all the same.